dealing with the false theory of the origin of man, the only one that is even worth considering because of its widespread acceptance of evolution, and we left off with the second argument against the theory of evolution, and that is the 2 or more million species. Remember, evolution is supposed to be a continuous, progressive change. And yet, most evolutionists are forced to admit that man is the pinnacle. Henry Drummond, in his Ascent of Man, says, on the earth there will never be a higher creature than man. And then he says, nature has succeeded in making a man she can go no further. Organic evolution has done her work. God, though, can do more, as man is a fallen creature. But if evolution is a continuous progression, why should it have this automatic stopper? Why should they say, since it has always been working for a couple of 3 million years up till now, and it's supposed to be a continuous thing, why stop now? And if it stops in man, will it stop in a monkey? Or in the animal kingdom? Maybe they'll pass us one of these days. For instance, it was one of the famous things here about 40 years ago, 35, 40 years ago, in a large church in New York City, they unveiled a statue they called the Chrysalis. It was of a young man emerging from an outworn ape skin. And it was probably apropos in that church. They were making monkeys out of themselves. But on the other side, I wish I had brought the picture to show you, but anyhow, on the other side, it shows an angel emerging from the same skin. Here's why Dr. Hubbard, in his Monkey Signs, Moon Signs and Monkey Signs, several other books, from a mud puddle to an archangel, shows that it must be still going upward if evolution is true. It can't have an automatic stopper. Too strong in species, too strong evolutionists, Professor Patterson and Professor Stone, writing on evolution in the genus Drosophila, fruit fly, had to admit the only alternative to evolution by selection among random mutations is direct mutations, possible only under supernatural guidance. Notice that, under supernatural guidance. That's the only other alternative, but they won't accept it. But he admits, science cannot hope on the theory of gradual change through mutations and selection to demonstrate the evolution of one species into another. I've come across this in I don't know how many evolutionary books. They have to admit they have not one iota of proof between species. This is why we'll take up very briefly a few of these missing links. It's a desperate effort, and finally abandoned by many, and accepting then a quantum jump, because you couldn't get any gradualism. There are too many species. Even Darwin, or rather in the introduction to Darwin's Origin of the Species in the 1956 edition, Darwin wrote, "Long before the reader has arrived at this point in my work, a cloud of difficulties will have occurred to him. Some of them are so serious that to this day I can hardly reflect on them without being in some degree staggered. Why, if species have descended from other species by a fine graduation, do not we everywhere see innumerable transitional forms?" Good question. It staggered him, but not quite enough. Then he continued, "Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain. And this perhaps," we can leave out the word perhaps, "and this perhaps is the most obvious and serious objection which can be urged against the theory." And you'll read this in one after another. In his book, Treasury of Science, on page 111, written in 1892, Archibald Geikie, atheist evolutionist, wrote, "There is, however, the important negative argument to evolution, furnished by the absence of evidence of recognizable specific variation between species of organic forms. Since man began to observe and record, we know that within human experience, a few species have become extinct. But there is no conclusive proof that a single new species has come into existence. Not out of 2 million. Nor are appreciable variations readily apparent in forms that live in a wild state. The seeds and plants found with Egyptian mummies and the fruits and flowers pictured on the tombs are recognizable specific variations observed now in Egypt." And then he goes further back to the geological ages prior to history. And I quote, "If we extend our vision beyond the narrow range of human history and look at the remains of the plants and animals preserved in those younger formations, which must be thousands of years older than in recorded history." Now notice, "the embalmed bodies of animals found in Egypt show no sensible divergence from the structure and proportions of the same animals at the present time." Where's your evolution? Now, there is no real evidence at all for evolution. This is the amazing thing. It shows a bias. It shows a darkened heart. It shows what they want to believe. It's so amazing that they can't find one proof of a crossover from species, one species to another. But then, notice, after all this, Geikie's guesses. As all evolutionists have to do if they want to keep on teaching it. He said, "We must admit that such transitions have occurred, that indeed they are now in progress." Well, innocently asked, give me one illustration. Show me a half monkey and a half man. Show me a half dill pickle and a half strawberry mix. But he says there has to be. You see, if you don't have God, and you don't have him, period, and the Bible is completely thrown out, then you've got to have it, even if you can't prove it. That's their dilemma. That's their problem. They admit, if you don't have that, then you've got to have a supernatural intervention. And that they cannot allow. Against all sense, against all evidence, against all logic, if we extend our vision beyond the narrow range of human history and look at the remains of the plants and animals preserved, well, let's go back. Let's start with this one. We must admit that such transitions have occurred and that indeed they are now occurring. Ever since organized existence began upon our planet, and doubtless takes place now. That's what's called begging the question in logic. Assuming what you set out to prove. It shows the utter unscientific nature of evolution. And also shows the bias. And it's in every one of their works. Some of the greatest of the botanists, paleontologists are ones who study fossil bones, and in almost every science, have had to admit, even though they didn't want to, they had to admit there's not one iota of evidence for evolution. Professor Etheridge of the British Museum of Natural History, one of the world's foremost experts on fossilology, said, in all of this great museum, there is not a particle of evidence of the transmutation of species. But this museum is full of proof of the utter falsity of the view. End of quotation. This man wanted the proof. He wanted the evidence. He had to admit there wasn't any. Professor William Bateson said before the American Association for the Advancement of Science, don't be discouraged. We may find it tomorrow. Now, mind you, out of a couple million living on the earth and 125 million that have lived upon the earth, he says, we haven't found it yet, but don't get discouraged. We may find it tomorrow. Hope springs eternal in the simian breast. Let's look at number three. There's much more, of course, on the species we could give. The third argument against evolution is the pure guesswork. Of course, we've been given this all along, but I want to be a little bit more specific. The pure guesswork it contains. Not science. It is credited to Napoleon Bonaparte to have said, it is funny what people will believe, so long as it's not in the Bible. I say, especially now, if it's called science. If I can find it, in an excellent little book written by Philip Morrow, who was a converted lawyer. I want you to see the logic here, and it takes a lawyer sometimes to be so logical. He said, imagine a litigant. That is someone who takes a case to court. A litigant in court upon whom rests all the burden of proof. And that's exactly what evolution has to do. It denies the scriptures. The accepted thing for over 1,500 years without really any question as far as creation is concerned. He comes into court and insists that all of his arguments are true and demands a verdict in his favor. But he brings no proof, only assertion. But all proof is against him. But he demands all of his suppositions could have been true. This is the thing I get in every one of the books. This is why every time I pick up an evolutionary book, I put down, tabulate all the suppositions. All the perhapses, the seems, it could be so. All the hypothetical things, the guesses. I'm utterly floored. You'll go, and every evolutionary book I've got, used as textbooks in universities, and I'm going to quote from Chordate Anatomy, Comparative Chordate Anatomy, and a couple of other books this morning. They will stumble bum around for two or three dozen pages, or sometimes even a half of the book, with probabilities. And then said, since the fact of evolution is not in dispute, and I've been disputing it all through that part of it. And my favorite, calling him a liar whenever I see that he's deliberately being dishonest. He knows better. A man can't live that long and go that far through school and not learn something. I know good and well he's lying through his teeth. He doesn't believe a word he's saying. He's deliberately dishonest. When he's been going all that long saying probable, and it is to be supposed, or it's reasonable to suppose, and then all of a sudden say it's a fact. Here's a man that has brought in no proof, but all proof is against him, and he's got a case in court. He demands all of his suppositions could have been true, well, might have been true. He is sure, since the opposite is impossible, it must be true. That's what every evolutionist does. He is saying four things. That all of his evidence, which ought to be there, are all destroyed. But second, if it could be found, it would be seen to be true. And third, he is sure someday it will be found and proved true. And then fourth, besides, all real thinking men of science are sure of his claims that they're true. Would the judge in the court agree? Brother, he'd be laughed out of court. And probably charged with obstructing justice. Yet that's the whole case for evolution. And you don't have to read far in any evolutionary book to see it. Here's why even Henry Drummond, by the way, Natural Law in the Spiritual World by Henry Drummond is a wonderful book. I don't think he was an evolutionist when he wrote that book. But brother, when he wrote The Ascent of Man, he had lost his marbles. He is the one who invented the term, and I saw it used just the other day, and it's been used a lot. He calls it the evolution of evolution. In other words, the whole theory of evolution is an evolution. It's grown on him. It has been proven that there have been at least 30 primary theories of evolution in the last half century, and every one has been changed. Thrown out and start a new one. Let me read just a little bit in this third argument, and then I want to give some more from outside. The pure guesswork, probabilities. Rather than an explanation of the origin of man, it is a patchwork of every man's guess against his brother's. This is plainly seen in every essay on evolution. Just note the various words denoting speculation. Professor Claude wrote, "The absence of facts forces us to confine ourselves largely to suggestions and probabilities." In his book, The Making of a Man. Again, in your notes, Professor Fairfield Osborne, who used to be one of the high priests of evolution, but in his latter years, he toned down all of his writings. You can read his earlier ones and read his later ones, and you'll find him differing greatly from the dogmatism of his early days. He is head of the American Museum of Natural History. Formerly a leader in the field of evolution, wrote, "The mode of the origin of life is a matter of pure speculation." See, these are evolutionists writing, not teaching Trinity College. I like a quote from them. "I know as soon as I read it that it's pure imagination. But I want you to show that they know it is too." Then he sets forth five theories or five hypotheses of the origin of life. He starts with the admission it is pure speculation. Darwin, in his Origin of the Species, used "it is supposed" and other suppositional expressions 800 times. 800. That's science. Professor Henry Osborne, on page 132 of this same book, The Mode of the Origin of Life, said, and I have even trouble reading some of these Latin expressions he uses, but I want to read this little sentence. "The Precambrian annelidan," or that's a worm-like stock, "arose out of the eripterid, may have come out of a scorpion. It is also possible the amphibious and terrestrial insects are the same. The true crustacean also probably developed of the same. Like a pearl necklace, he dangles an hypothesis on which he hangs a supposition, to which he attaches a guess, on which he pins a bare possibility, and finally arrives at the gem of an assumption." That's science, as the Bible Authorized Version really says, so called. In the two books I've just finished reading again, I've read them 3 or 4 times. About every time I teach this class, I like to read it over again just to get it in my mind. Used at Yale University. Written by the heads of 5 different departments and 1 article by the president of Yale University on the evolution of the earth and the evolution of man. In these two books, they use the word evolution 455 times. Now, this is the whole idea that if you use a word or a term or a supposition often enough, people will finally get the idea that it must be so. It's the same idea of Hitler and Stalin, and they said in those days, if a man tells a lie often enough and large enough, most people will believe you before you get through, just by repetition. These two books are liberally sprinkled the first book over 90 times and the second book over 150 times with suppositional expressions. I mean every page with suppositions, hypothetical. probabilities. Every imaginational suppositional term is used. For example, it is asserted, assuming, hypothetical, hypothesis, theory, it is possible, it seems, it can well be imagined, we believe, and this is an amazing thing, 25 times it uses faith, believe, and yet we're supposed to be a religion and they're not. They have to use faith. I have a little article, I may read some of it, by Henry Morris of the Bible Science Research Association on the splendid faith of the evolutionists. Brother, and he goes in here, it takes more faith to believe their nonsense than it does the Bible even. So the Bible does have facts on its side. They don't have any. It may be inferred, an inference he used a great number of times, reasonable to believe, opinion, estimate, supposedly, tentatively. It is hoped, practically certain, fortuitous, accidental. It happened. All suppositional terms. And then he winds up, no informed person feels any longer the need to argue the truth of evolution. So when I'm arguing, it shows I'm no informed person. Every book I read has just about the same ratio. This chordate forms, comparative chordate forms book, used at California Institute of Technology. Has about the same ratio. But all built upon guesswork. Let me quote another couple of evolutionists. Joseph McCabe, in his book Evolution, says, evolution is the most dreary example of unblushing guesswork ever foisted on the public in the name of science. Evolution. Dr. W. R. Thompson, in the foreword to the latest edition of Darwin's Origin of the Species, in the foreword, recommending the book. But he's really apologizing for its guesswork. And here's the quotation in the preface. It's put out by Hill and McCraw, naturally, 1979. Origin of the Species by Charles Darwin. The forward by Dr. W. R. Thompson. Quotation marks. As we know, there is a great divergency of opinion among biologists, not only about the causes of evolution, but even the actual process. These divergencies exist because the evidence is unsatisfactory and does not permit any certain conclusion. A dollar. Continue. One of the non-scientific public to the disagreement about evolution. This situation where men rally to the defense of the doctrine they are unable to defend scientifically, much less demonstrate the scientific vigor, attempting to maintain its credit with the public by a suppression of criticism and the elimination of difficulties is abnormal and undesirable in science. I don't know why they got this guy to write the preface. Except the whole book is just exactly that. and he's honest. But I don't imagine that Peth has sold many books. Let's look at a few of the guesses. And of course, one of the largest areas of guesses is in the field of missing links. We could take the whole class on the missing, or even a whole week or two on missing links. You could find some good books, some by even evolutionists, downgrading the missing links. As we said, the biggest thing about the missing links is they're still missing. As we quoted that one man, that great evolutionist, there are no connecting links at all. Intermediate forms, none. But that doesn't discourage a good evolutionist, like Louis Leakey, who spent 40 years in Alluvial Gorge just north of Kenya. And finally, not too long before he died, he manufactured one. He found in a gorge, now mind you, scattered over some 50 feet, about a handful of bones. He could not date them by carbon-14 dating. Every evolutionist today knows that carbon-14 is no good after about 4,000 or 5,000 years. In fact, if you'll get a pin really down, it's no good before the flood. About 3,000 years B.C. For the canopy would ruin that whole decay of carbon-14. The whole thing. It would change the whole ratio. Now, they have compared carbon-14 with the bristle cone pine, the rings in a bristle cone pine, which is a lot more accurate, though there are some discrepancies there, but they're not as marked. And have found that it works pretty good back to the flood. Before that, they will take recognized bones of the same animal and find sometimes 1,000 or 2,000 years difference in the age of it in carbon-14. Now, argon dating and so on, radiation dating, is open to all kinds of questions. I'm not going to go into carbon dating and radiation dating. But Leakey knew that, and he didn't even try, now mind you, his mother and his son, neither one, did it either. He wouldn't try carbon-14 because he needed a bigger date than that. He wanted a find that would supersede all the bones that went before. So he dated the rocks and the dust around about the bones and came up with 1.5 million years. That predates practically any of the other missing links, so made him a little higher than all the rest. They were always buying for this. Well, his son Richard, who wasn't even a paleontologist, didn't like that, so he went over and began to scrape around and found some more bones. And he had 1 million years to him. Mary Leakey couldn't be outdone by her husband or her son, so she went over and found some more bones. And she had 1 million years. Now, mind you, not by the bones themselves, but the place where they were found, in a riverbed. Rocks in a riverbed. How do they know they even came there with the bones? Or the bones came there, or were buried right there, or were washed down in the gully. How silly can you get? This whole idea of dating fossils by the rocks and the rocks by the fossils is circular reasoning. And the evolutionists recognize this. I've got all kinds of quotations at the house written by evolutionists who criticize these datings of the missing links by the rocks or the fossils by the rocks. You say, how old you, how do you, how old do you know the rocks are? Well, the fossil bones found in it shows it had to be in the Cambrian geological age. Well, how do you know the fossils were that old by the rocks in which they were found? It's like a dog chasing its tail. Let's look at a few of these marvelous missing links just briefly now, very briefly. The Java Man, Dr. William Diesler of the University of Berlin, ardently defended the Java Man as a genuine fossil missing link by saying, the eye sockets are man-like, rather than ape-like. And in his book, he said he based his whole argument on the eye sockets. Now, that's absolutely beautiful when you consider the eye sockets were manufactured out of plaster of Paris. For all they had was the top of the skull in the dawn, in the Java Man. All they had was three teeth and a little piece of the skull cake. Another happy find, as they called it, was the Dawn Man, Eanthropus Dawsoni, called up Dawson, the founder of it, famous fake. The Piltdown Man. Boy, it was hailed as a wonderful find. I can remember the day when they discovered it was a fake. So-called Sussex Man. Supposed to screen the dust in this cave to find a few fragments and join together to manufacture one missing link. Then all of a sudden, they found out how crooked Prospera found it. They had nothing but a little piece of skull bone and then a few teeth and a lower jaw. The bones were stained to make age. And the teeth in the jaw were filed to make them more human looking. And it was thrown out as a 100% fake. You'll still find it in books. I found it in one, not an old book either, not written before it was discovered to be a fake. It's no longer in the Museum of Natural History in Great Britain, by the way, since it was discovered to be a pure fake. All manufactured. Yet it was hailed at the time as one of the greatest finds, as a missing link between a monkey and a man. The jawbone was a monkey bone, and the paint was human, so it is a missing link after it's manufactured. The Heidelberg Man, another fake. All they had was a lower jaw. The rest was missing. That they manufactured his beetle-browed wife and his monkey-looking baby. Got the whole family out of about 5 ounces of bones. Yet now it's proven to be a fake. We can go through all the Neanderthal men, which evidently were, some of them were pygmies, but some of them were about 8 feet tall. The Cro-Magnon Man had a bigger brain capacity than most moderns. There are no missing links, no intermediate forms. Either they're all monkey or all human. Like I said, you could go out to any cemetery in the country, and you could find all kinds of freaks. You could find people with small heads. I don't know why they don't go out there and find those shrunken heads and say, well, here's a real small human that's really a monkey and a human. You could find those mongoloids with the body retarded and the head still growing. And monstrosity. I saw this man in a Pampa parade one time from a circus freak. He was over 8 feet tall. Disease, deformity, genetic deformity, can make all kinds of freaks. Digging up one single bone or even a whole skeleton and find out it's malformed, say, well, that's the missing link. It doesn't have to be. It's like this Nebraska man they found out here. That was hailed all sorts of great times. Million years old. Earliest man at that time until the leakies came along. The Nebraska man. They built a whole man out of one tooth. And it was hailed as a great time. Until they found out it was a tooth of a pig. And that's making a man out of a pig, not a monkey. There's an extinct hickory, they call it. Pig. Proven. No doubt at all. Good paleontologist proved what it was. We can go on down the list. There are no intermediate forms, as every evolutionist admits. None at all. Let's look at a few of the guesses. You don't have to read Grimm's fairy tales. You can read any evolutionary book, and you'll find some real fairy tales. I like Harry Rimmer's guessology. Exactly what it is. Darwin, in his Ascent of Man, and I just read that not too long ago, explains how the ape lost its hair, its fur. The female apes, like their mates, with less hair. In other words, they maybe were like a bald-headed mate. So they chose mates with less hair. I can see Mrs. H putting a sign in a banana tree, no hairy apes need apply. I want thin head. Husband only. So gradually, now this is Darwin's beautiful guessology. So gradually evolved hairless mates. About the same time they became human. There are so many beautiful coincidences in all this silly monkey shines. Why should a monkey like a less hairy monkey? Everyone I've ever seen in a zoo loves to go hunting in the fur of its mate. You watch it. And then eat it, whatever they find. Big fat pit, you know, whatever it is. Who ever heard of an animal choosing a mate by appearance? That's why natural selection is thrown out. They never do. It's only availability, not on ability. Animals are promiscuous. And as far as the ape clan, they all live in herds. And the females are all bigamists. And so are the males. They never choose them by the amount of hair or the lack of hair. Like that whole theory of how we lost that long, beautiful tail. Almost every one of them that dares to theorize it on it at all say we lost it by sitting on it. Too much. Why haven't most of the monkeys lost theirs? They've sat on it too. And who ever heard of sitting on your shoulders or on your head? Look at a few other theories. They get more beautiful as you go along. The reason a baby can wiggle its big toe and not the others is the time when they climbed in trees. And the reason all babies have that tremendous grasp, even almost at only a few weeks old age, so that you can pick them up, you put your finger in their hands and they'll grip it, and then you can hold them up. That's also from climbing in the tree. And the reason the hair naturally runs this way on your elbow, you watch it. I can show it to you on mine if I didn't have a coat on, is while sitting on a limb in the forest, they protected their head from the rain. And the rain made the hair go this way. This is evolution. It's the wild guesses. There's no end to it. The reason that we often dream of falling and never getting hurt. Now, this is in evolutionary books. The reason we dream of falling and don't get hurt is that the baby monkeys fell out of the tree. And naturally, the ones that got killed didn't leave any descendants. Like us, to dream about falling and not getting hurt. It was the ones who fell and didn't get hurt that left the descendants. Now that's logical. I think. Now we've already seen how you got your eyes in these wild guesses, these glazed over freckles. The 30 million parts. But did you ever realize how you got your legs? This is beautiful. The very earliest worm-like ancestors discovered a useful wart on their bellies. And they found if they used that little wart, now you try using a wart if you can. They found by using that little wart, they could overcome or go faster than the other ones. They became useful. And the bipedal ancestors had two warts. And then, of course, with the two warts, you could do a whole lot more. Now, it is amazing that some worms had two warts, no three, two warts, four warts, six warts, eight warts, 100 warts, 1,000 leggers. I used to love to watch a 1,000 legger walk and see the wave-like legs as they walked. I don't think they had 1,000. I never counted them, but they were a lot of them anyhow. You think of the warts that took. So don't, by any means, destroy a wart on you. You don't have to tell them what it might produce. Unless you see it producing the wrong thing, you've got to kill it. There are so many of those deathologies. Look at the age of the earth in your notes. You do come back to it once in a while. Every evolution, almost without an exception, uses its own particular amount of zeros to get age. By the way, don't let anybody ever fool you about the geological table. In every textbook on geology, except those written by Christians, and I don't think that Christians should use it at all. I really get aggravated when I read after a good writer who is debunking evolution, and then he'll quote Cambrian age and archaic age and all the rest of them for some half a billion years. And of course, when I think Lyell was the first one to manufacture this table, and he wasn't a geologist, he wasn't a scientist. But he only took 500 million years in his table. Now, of course, the geologists just go overboard on time schedules. I can remember about 30 years ago, it was 4 billion years. Now, then 15 billion years. I just read an article not too long ago, or not much more than a month, I think, where they were talking about 30 billion years. And of course, it's deathology, pure and simple. But as far as the origin of man is concerned, you can take any evolutionist you want to and get a different date. I think they want originality, but of course none of them are so make up your own. They always remind me of the guy that was touring the British Museum of Natural History. And when he came to that big dinosaur, there was a janitor there cleaning up the place. And he asked the dinosaur, he said, how old is that dinosaur? He said, 1,000,003.5 years. He looked at him in utter amazement. He said, that is wonderful. How can you get so precise? He said, well, I asked the curator 3.5 years ago how old it was, and he said 1,000,000 years. So naturally now it's 1,000,003.5. Look at the time element. When guessing at the age of man upon the earth, their guesses range at some 300 million years apart. Darwin's was probably the oldest. Meyer says that the Stone Age was not thousands of years, but millions of years. Zukot says man is 135,000 years old. Osborne, 500,000. James Geekie, 200,000. Crow, 980,000. Townsend, bless his little pointed head, comes closer than anybody else. 6,000 years. That's a happy guess. So whenever you read some great scientist talking about geological ages, don't take it with a grain of salt. Take it with a whole Salt Lake Flat. Because he doesn't know a thing in the world he's talking about. He's purely guessing. I wish we had time to take the wild guesses of the recapitulation theory. You can read it in almost any anti-evolutionary book. Of the three little wrinkles on the side of the fetus before it's born. And it was before the days of real science, in the sense of more exact examination of various parts of the body and so on. It's proven to be a complete foolishness. recapitulation theory, and they've got all kinds of names for it, and I'm not going into it in our class. We'll take the last one in the anti-God nature of evolution, and then I want to read you my wonderful poem in our next lesson. But certainly, there's no idea at all in this idea that the embryo recapitulates the whole life history of evolution. From the amoeba, or the protozoan, to man. It's an arbitrary taking pictures of certain ages of the fetus, the embryo, and saying that was when we were so-and-so, there's a worm. They even have a time when the corset, or that little tail at the end of the backbone, curves out, looks like about, it wouldn't be that long in the little fetus, but 3 or 4 inches longer than it should be, but that's before the rest of the backbone develops. They say that little thing on the end of your spinal column was the remnant of the tail you used to have in your ancestors. But the fact of the matter is, it is an anchor for the muscles of the thighs. They have to have some place to anchor. And they say those muscles were to wag the tail. I don't know of any real scientist today in morphology or study of the human body or anatomy that believes in that theory. As in all the vestigial organs. They're all manufactured in man's idea. Wasn't the bell supposed to ring? They did? I didn't hear it. Lewis Nurse.